But first, Flint has its first new master plan in more than 50 years. Last night, the Flint City Council approved the plan, which calls for stabilizing neighborhoods hard hit by blight and creating new opportunities for business investment. Scott Kincaid is the president of the Flint City Council. He likes the new master plan.
But it all comes down to money. You know, you can't do a lot of things without having the right funding and the funding sources.
City officials and residents spent the last 2 years coming up with this plan. Flint, of course, is about 50 miles northwest of Detroit. It's been under state oversight since 2011. The city currently is dealing with $3 million in structural debt. Nina Ignacek is a writer for Issue Media Group, and she's been digging into this new master plan. Welcome back to the program, Nina.
Thank you.
Well, you put this in some pretty great context when you made the point in your story that the last time the city of Flint adopted a master plan, Elvis Presley had been promoted to sergeant in the Army.
Yes.
Why did it take more than 50 years to get an updated master plan?
Well, it wasn't for lack of trying. The city did, over the years, try to establish master plans. There were several efforts in the 1970s and 1980s, but none were ever formally adopted. There's a few reasons for this. There was a lot of turmoil politically as the automotive industry pulled out of the city, but also the planning staff and the planners at that time really didn't make the effort to engage the community. So this was the first time that they were really able to get everybody in the community working together, working on the same page.
Well, it certainly seems consequences happened for Flint for not having this updated roadmap to help guide the city.
Yes, absolutely. Megan Hunter, the planning chief planning officer with the city, talked about in cases in which infrastructure was laid down, roads were laid down on roads where there were only one or two houses. So this plan hopefully creates more of a comprehensive look at the city and will help them better plan for the future because they've looked at the information, they looked at their demographics, and they've got a vision of where they want to be.
And they talked to a lot of people, didn't they?
Yes, they talked. She mentioned that they talked to over 250 interactions and they've reached over 5,000 people.
So a lot of voices. So, Nina, what are the main parts of Flint's new master plan?
Well, the plan is divided up into chapters. So they talk a little bit of background of the community and an overall vision. They have a land use plan, a housing and neighborhoods plan, a transportation and mobility plan, an environmental features plan, an infrastructure and community facilities plan, an economic development plan, a public safety, health, and welfare plan, and an arts and culture plan, and an implementation plan for all of that. So it's very comprehensive.
Very, very comprehensive. One of the things I wanted to talk about with you is one of these central features is a road diet.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, a road diet, like it sounds, is making a road smaller. As is the case in Detroit and in Flint and in a lot of the older industrial cities, the roads are way over capacity for the amount of traffic that is currently using them. And so they're really not providing a benefit to the community because they're large roads, they're hard to cross, they take up a lot of space. So a road diet really tries to reduce possibly the number of lanes in the road or the width of the road and to use that the other areas of the road for other purposes. So it may be a bike lane, it may be public space. There's a whole variety of things that can go into a road diet. And one of the biggest advantages is that they really provide an opportunity to knit areas together that had been divided by these large major roads.
Well, I can only imagine, for example, 475, which people see every time they head from Detroit up north. You see that 475, and really that was designed to get people to and from auto plants, wasn't it?
Exactly. And 475 is one of the major roads that is underutilized at this point. I did ask Megan about that because, as you may know, in Detroit, there's talk right now about I-375, which is a similar connector and potentially boulevarding that road.
Right.
And changing the configuration. She said that there had not been talk about doing a similar treatment to 475. Their road diets are really targeting other roads in the city. But she did mention that they had been looking to find ways to connect neighborhoods that had been separated by 475 in the past through other means, like actually building tunnels below the road and that kind of thing. So they definitely are looking at ways to address it.
And they could do that in a cost-conscious way, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be much less expensive than decommissioning a freeway.
Well, in fact, let's talk about the overall plan, a very ambitious plan. We heard Scott Kincaid at the top of this interview saying it all comes down to money. Money is scarce. They're under state oversight. Are there no cost or low cost ways to implement the plan and take the city where the plan spells out?
There will be lower cost, low hanging fruit type of implementation that they'll be looking at implementing immediately. And a lot of this will come out of the partnerships that they've built through this process. So they've partnered really closely with the medical facilities, the colleges, and they have a great partnership with the MTA, the Metro Transit Authority, so that as the Metro Transit Authority goes to implement its projects, it will take into account the things that have been laid down in the Flint plan, and hopefully there'll be a partnership for funding there. Foundations in the community have also been very active, but it is going to require some of the larger projects are going to require some serious money going forward, and they'll be looking for grants and partnerships and things like that to implement the plan.
Well, as you talk to representatives of Flint's community, whether it is employers or hospitals or foundations or the local leaders, is the will there to make this thing happen? I guess what I'm trying to ask, Nina, do you think this really is, this master plan, something that will make a difference in Flint, or could it easily slip back to window dressing, something to wave at the rest of the state going, look, we're trying, but never really acting on it?
Well, I think that's the same question that could be asked of a lot of our cities that are trying to create these plans. The city of Detroit with Detroit Future City is kind of in the same boat, and it's really going to be dependent upon all of the partners in maintaining that momentum. And I think Flint has seen some major development in the last 10 years. They've really done a lot with their downtown. There's been a lot of urban farming that's sprung up over the years. There's been some new businesses. So I think there is a bit of a buzz happening. And the question is, can that be capitalized upon? Can the good economy, the economic recovery be sustained long enough to let things happen? Our old Rust Belt cities are definitely challenged in these ways. But I do think that they've built a coalition through this process unlike anything they've really had before. So I think they have a really good chance.
Do you you may or may not be able to answer this, but it makes me wonder. It seems that Flint and Detroit, as you point out, they have similar master plans. Let's look ahead, plan for the future. Many of the same challenges. Is one city or the other further ahead down this road of making this happen? Is perhaps Flint further down than Detroit, or can Detroit teach things to Flint? Where are they at?
You know, I think Detroit certainly has a lot of advantages in some respects because it's really got the eyes of the nation on it, and it has Dan Gilbert and a lot of the boosters that are trying to really push things forward and make things happen as far as private investment, and we're getting M1 rail and things like that in Detroit. But on the other hand, you know, Flint's not undergoing bankruptcy at this point, so you know, whether that's going to be a detriment to Detroit or an advantage, I think that remains to be seen. Detroit just has a lot more attention being paid to it, but Flint has a lot of the same issues and problems, and there are a lot of the same causes of those problems. So I'd say they're pretty comparable, and they probably would benefit from some sharing of ideas between the two.
Nina Ignacek, writer for Issue Media Group, as she takes us through some of the details and the repercussions of Flint's first new master plan in more than 50 years. Nina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We've begun noticing something interesting when some of us have gone out to eat lately. Instead of being handed a menu on the traditional plastic-coated paper or a book form, some restaurants are handing us tablets. Chili's Grill and Bar has been testing tablets, allowing diners to order drinks and desserts, even pay the bill without having to flag down a waiter. Well, it's been so successful in the 180 or so test restaurants that the company plans to install tablet menus at most of its 1,266 U.S. restaurants. And the Real Seafood Company in Ann Arbor recently began using tablet menus. And that got us wondering about menus, about eating out. What does a society and the way it eats out say about all of us? Joining us is Dr. Rebecca Spang. She's with the Department of History at Indiana University, where she directs the Center for 18th Century Studies, and she's the author of The Invention of the Restaurant, and she joins us now from Bloomington. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
So when did eating out become an event, if you will, a form of recreation?
people, of course, have always had to eat out. For most of human history, most people haven't had kitchens of their own. They certainly haven't had dining rooms. And so people have eaten in the streets. People have requested alms. But going out as an enjoyable leisure activity, as something that you would plan to do even though you actually had a kitchen and a dining room and several servants.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that starts in the 1770s and the 1780s.
And where?
In France, and more specifically in Paris, actually.
Oh, well, we can thank the Parisians then as we plan our Friday night dinner plans.
That's right.
And why did that happen? What was behind that?
Well, to make a very long story short, what I have argued is that it emerges from the culture of sensibility, which is central to 18th century culture in many, many different ways. And part of the culture of sensibility is the idea that your physical taste and your aesthetic taste and your moral awareness of the world are all perfectly calibrated to each other.
Hmm.
So that if you have very good taste in food, you must also be exquisitely sensitive to the suffering of others. And, of course, that's a social virtue. You don't want to display how sensitive you are to other people's problems sitting at home by yourself.
There you go. So there
so you go out to eat, or, in fact, in the very first restaurants, not to eat, but to show that your appetite is so exquisite that you can just barely manage to sip a little cup of restorative bouillon. That's why they're called restaurants. And make a public show of your private sensibility.
And then would we, it sounds like when you're saying sipping that cup of restorative bouillon, that we would not recognize the restaurant of the late 1700s as related to what we go in today, where we're having our monster portions.
Right. That's right. In the very first restaurants, we wouldn't recognize it. But interestingly, within 3 or 4 years, the first people calling themselves restaurateurs are also providing menus printed from very, very early on. And the idea is that, of course, since everybody's ailments and everybody's appetites and tastes are a little bit different, you can't just say, tonight we're serving pork and beans. So you give people the choice in the format of a menu.
And as you say, they were printed and handed as someone walked in.
Yes, they seem to have been from very, very early on. There is also a very long tradition in the French context, which we sometimes do still see today in various restaurants, of writing the menu either on a chalkboard or in what today would be a dry erase marker on a mirror.
Sure. We see that still very, very often. Or today's specials are there,
yes,
when you come in, which is a,
right,
which is probably saves a lot of money not having to reprint a menu every day.
That's right. But it's, and it, I think it also is a way of asserting that what we're announcing as a special really is special.
Yeah. Did the restaurant concept jump pretty quickly to the rest of the continent, to England, and then did it make a quick jump across the Atlantic to America?
It's actually somewhat slow. For the first decade of the 19th century, you will find travelers from Great Britain, travelers from North America, from Germany, going to Paris and saying, wow, they have these things there called restaurants, and there are people eating in public, like middle-class families. This is so strange. And the British actually say, well, this is because the French, they have no sense of domestic home life.
So
it actually isn't, in the British context, the equivalent institution, which is not completely equivalent, would be a gentleman's club.
Okay.
They're the ones that have the famous chefs in the mid-19th century. And in the British context, it's really only at the mid to end 19th century when you start to see the building of really lavish hotels, like, say, the Ritz, that will then have restaurants in them run by French chefs. In the American case, the dynamic is a little bit different, in part because the country is, of course, being settled. People are moving and dispersing across the continent. So that's a somewhat different story.
You know, we see this move now towards these high-tech menus with the tablets. Chili's research found that the tablets lead to higher tips, to people ordering more appetizers than desserts, and it also gets diners out faster. Do you see these tablet menus as a helpful development or something that's potentially negative?
I cannot say that I'm enamored of it because it immediately reminds me that tomorrow morning when I go to the airport, I am going to have to check myself in. And I'm going to have to check in my own bag, too. And that has allowed airlines to lay off workforce. So people are being replaced by machines. The argument is, of course, that it's more efficient. But I wonder about that, and I wonder at the human cost, and certainly when I think about how harried the few remaining airline employees always seem to be, I wonder about it. And it seems to me that part of the attraction might be the sense of immediacy that it gives diners, that there isn't anybody between them and the kitchen.
Yes.
And, I mean, there's a long tradition of anecdotes about rude waiters, surly waiters, incompetent waiters. And so it would seem that the tablet allows us to go out to eat without having to interact with other human beings at all.
Very interesting point. We'll have to see if this is just a fad or a development that academicians 100 years from now will be talking about.
Right. And if they are, they will link it to the related phenomenon of people sitting there taking photos of their dinner with their telephones.
Oh, which I'm sure the first Parisians would be just aghast. Dr. Rebecca Spang with the Department of History at Indiana University. Her book is The Invention of the Restaurant. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, Dr. Spang.
You're very welcome. Good to talk to you, too.
Father and daughter duo San and Emily are Sandor and Emily Slomovitz of Ann Arbor. Their new album, titled Innocent When You Dream, is full of surprising song choices, set off with their voices, their guitars, and Emily's evocative violin. And although traditional wisdom has it that kids aren't particularly interested in their parents' music, it is not so with San and Emily. And they join us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
San, you're very well known around Ann Arbor for playing with your twin brother, Laz. And he was recently on the program with us with his CD. You called yourselves Gemini. But tell me, how did this partnership with your daughter develop?
You know, my brother and I have been doing this professionally for about 40 years now. My daughter is now 19, and we started bringing her up on stage with us when she was about 9. And I had no plans of, you know, her following in my footsteps. It was just fun to do. And then she just became a wonderful violinist. She started studying around the age of 8. She became a wonderful violinist and a singer. And we started doing shows, just the two of us. And it's just developed into where, when it started, it was this thing of dad and his little girl.
Yeah.
It's not at all that anymore. It's an equal partnership, and it's wonderful.
That has to be a thrilling moment for a parent.
Absolutely.
That's my little girl who's all grown up, and she's a wonderful musician.
Yeah. And I've seen her in ways that I never see her. I've seen her on stage in ways that I never see her at home. In other words, there are aspects of her that come out on stage or in the studio that that you just don't see when she's just being the kid at home.
Well, Emily, how do you see Dad differently now that you're actually performing with him?
I mean, it's not too different for me, I think, somehow, just because I think I've also grown up watching Gemini on stage, and so it's sort of an extension of that in a way, but it is something that's really nice to share and to feel like almost an equal.
Nothing almost about it.
And to just have something that we can do together that is so much fun for both of us.
Do you both go into a different place when it's time to get out and perform? And by that, I mean if there was stuff happening at home or some tensions at home or whatever, does that become part of another world when you get into the studio or you go out on a stage?
Absolutely for me. I mean, it's always been that way. I sometimes feel so lucky that I get to do this because no matter what happened 5 minutes before the show, once the show starts, that's gone. And I'm just totally involved in what I'm doing, and I get so much back from doing that it's hard to be in a bad mood after you've been playing music for 10 minutes. It really is.
I was so struck with the wonderfully eclectic choice of songs on San and Emily's album. You get their interpretations, for example, of a famous old anti-war song from Pete Seeger.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago.
Or there's a Dave Brubeck jazz classic.
Won't you stop and take a little time out with me? Just take five, just take five.
Or even Henry Mancini. So, Sam, what were you looking for when you decided which songs to include on your CD? I had not thought of Guantanamera in such a long time, but at the same time, you've got Sting, you know, you've got Tom Waits. It's just a delicious array of songs.
Well, thank you. We've been saying how Emily has learned stuff, our music. It's actually worked the other way around as well. So a number of those songs are songs that I would not have come across necessarily on my own that I would have considered performing if it hadn't been for Emmy.
Such as? So,
well, the Sting song, the Until. Mm-hmm. We were watching that. That song is the soundtrack of a movie that we particularly like. So we were watching that movie. When that song comes around at the end, we looked at each other and go, that's one for us. It's not one I would have ever imagined my brother and I doing. The Guantanamera actually came about because my brother and I have been organizing this Pete Seeger benefit at the Arc for a number of years now. And we've been looking at songs that Pete has brought, and that was one of them. The reason we do that, though, is because Emmy is such a wonderful Spanish speaker and singer. If I sing it, it sounds
not so great.
Not so
interesting.
Great. But Emmy's Spanish is wonderful, so we sing that song because she sounds very good on it.
What do you want people to get out of the music you make? Emily, I'll start with you with that question.
Well, I mean, I feel like they should make of it what they want, but I hope that they see these songs, maybe the more familiar ones, in a new way, or that since we have some ones that people may not have heard of, that they find new material that they enjoy and that they say, oh, I'll go listen to the original, and it makes them start liking some certain song or artist.
Taking them on a musical journey.
Yeah.
How about you, Sam?
You know, I'll be very selfish. I sing these songs for me, first of all.
Well, yeah.
I love singing these songs, and I hope actually that is what people get from them. That people can have the same kind of relationship to the songs or to music that I feel when I'm doing them.
Mm-hmm. What do you each admire about the other as a musician? Dad, you first. What do you admire most about your daughter as a musician?
Well, I'll say this. Emmy is 19 now, and I think back to when I was 19 and where I was musically. She is so far ahead of me. So I just admire. I sit next to her and hear her play the violin, and frequently this happens, that I'll just tear up. There's just such a beautiful sound in what she's creating. The singing is the same thing that her voice is so different from mine. I mean, my brother and I have very similar voices. Mm-hmm. I'm used to singing harmony with him. I sing in a completely different way when I sing harmony with her. And it's just, I admire that sound that she's able to make. And frankly, one of the things that I've always admired about her, she is so relaxed and comfortable on stage.
And Emily, what do you admire most about Dad's music?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with it, and so it's, I think it has influenced how I listen to other music, and I think also the way that he sings is something that I have sort of, I'm really happy that he just lets his voice do what it's going to do, and he's not singing in a sort of classical vein, but his voice is maybe more of that ilk, and so I've been kind of inspired by that to let my voice just sort of do what it's going to do and not try to sound like anybody else.
San and Emily Slomovitz, the Ann Arbor-based father and daughter duo. Their CD is called Innocent When You Dream, and it is out on their label, Gemini Records. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
If I caught the world in a bottle and everything was still beneath the moon, without your love, would it shine for me? If I was smart as Aristotle and understood the rings around the moon.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Much attention in D.C. is being paid this week to the problems with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act website and allegations of spying by the NSA on American allies. But there are plenty of political watchers who are keeping a very close eye on the fallout from the government shutdown and the debt ceiling debate. Campaign operatives wondering, how will the government shutdown affect election 2014? Much of the blame of the shutdown focused on Republicans, particularly House Republicans. Michigan's Democrats in D.C. all voted in favor of reopening the government without changing the Affordable Care Act. Republican lawmakers from Michigan, however, were split. Among the state's 9 GOP representatives, 4 voted yes, 5 voted no. So let's look at how the shutdown might affect Republican congressional seats in Michigan in next year's midterm election. Joining us now is Brian Dickerson, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Welcome to Stateside, Brian.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And we welcome Ken Sikkema. Ken's a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants, and he's the former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. Thank you so much for joining us, Ken.
Oh, happy to be with you.
Ken, let me start with you. How badly do you feel the shutdown and the standoff hurt Michigan's Republicans?
Oh, I think I think Republicans took it on the chin here. As you already indicated, the polling nationally indicates that the vast majority of voters blame Republicans. There's a recent poll done by CNN that said 75% of Americans think that no Republican ought to be reelected to Congress. And my own view, frankly, is that the Republican Party has to reject this very extreme and very radical strategy of bringing everything and everybody down just because you don't get your way on one policy issue.
Brian, even though we've heard countless sound bites from hopping mad citizens during the standoff, basically saying, get rid of them all, even the ones we like, do you think that that anger will carry over until Election Day 2014?
Well, I'm not at all confident that it will. If we know anything, it's that both journalists and their audience have a very short attention span, and it seems to have shifted already to the difficulties with the startup of the Affordable Health Care Act. But we have Ken on the line. I would like to ask him a question. It used to be that when you were negotiating with the Speaker of the Republican House, he could speak for most of Michigan's congressional delegation. He was speaking for Candace Miller, for people like Tim Walberg and Bill Zynga. And this time, over and over again through these negotiations, it became apparent that Speaker Boehner wasn't speaking for those people and wasn't speaking for lots of other Republicans. What has happened? What is the calculation of somebody like Candace Miller, who was elected, very popular on a statewide basis, in positioning herself contrary to the Republican leadership on such a high-profile issue?
Well, I can't speak for any individual congressperson, whether it's Candace Miller or anybody else in the Michigan delegation. But my personal opinion is that a lot of them are operating under pure fear. They're afraid of primaries being waged against them. They're afraid of, the Tea Party sort of influence, tactically is, if you don't agree with us 100% of the time, we're going to run somebody against you. So I think fear is rampant either in Congress or even here in Michigan. And so they've rejected the notion of any kind of leadership. There really is no leadership today. It's every man and woman for him and herself, and they're afraid of what could happen to them in a primary. There is no, in my opinion, Brian, there's no other way to explain these five Republican no votes that, if they were successful, would have not only continued the shutdown, would have put America in default, which is, I mean, even Warren Buffett said it's sort of the nuclear option. So
Yeah. That's
my view.
And is it not fair for the voters of America to expect that when we send someone to Congress, they're there for the country, not for fear of their own hides?
Well, go ahead. I'm sure it's fair to expect that. I'm not sure it's ever been realistic to expect that. I think that's always been a consideration for incumbents in both parties. It used to be that people who were concerned about their own longevity had to pay a lot more attention to voters from the other party, and in Michigan, to independent voters in particular. They had to worry about staying in the good graces of their party's leadership, whichever party they belonged to, because that was an important source of political and financial support come re-election time. Now that calculus has been upset. Most all of our congressmen represent places where the boundaries have been drawn to heavily favor one party or the other, and they're just not vulnerable to a challenge from the other side. So I'm sure Congresswoman Miller loses not a single night of sleep worrying about how Democratic voters will avenge themselves in her heavily Republican district. She's solely concerned, as Senator Sikkema suggests, with a challenge from her right flank. And the same is true, frankly, of Democrats who, like Kildee, in districts that are 60, 70, 75% Democratic. They don't have to worry about Republican moderates. So I think that's probably the most important factor that's changed.
What about some polls showing, or some analysts are saying, for example, talk about Justin Amash. He is more conservative than his district. I know public policy polling found if the election happened today, 47% of voters would choose a Democratic opponent and 43% would choose Amash. Now, granted, this is a Democratic polling firm, but Ken, has Justin Amash been damaged by this standoff in your view?
Oh, I think so. He will face a credible conservative Republican challenge in his district, a person who's already announced. Who's going to mount, by all indications, a very aggressive, well-funded campaign. Frankly, I think any incumbent congressman, if the election were actually held this November, actually I think a number of them would get defeated because of the anger that's out there. And they would get defeated not because they have any great opponent, but just because they were there. Now, as Brian mentioned, and I agree with him, that the election is actually a year from now, and people's memory is so short and so many things will happen that this current anger might dissipate. But, yes, Congressman Amash is going to have a credible opponent, and that opponent will use his position on this issue, among other issues. But really, the elections come down to having these credible opponents. I mean, you can't, a year from now, when the anger that's currently out there sort of dissipates, you're not going to defeat somebody with nobody.
Well, let's talk about credible opponents and switch over to the 11th district. Brian, your column in this past, in recent Free Press, Sunday Free Press, GOP establishment has turned its back on Kerry Bentivoglio. Kind of recap for us what your observations were.
Well, I've called Congressman Bentivoglio in the past the accidental congressman because he came to office under such bizarre and unusual circumstances. He filed as a primary opponent against a heavily favored incumbent, Thad McCotter, and had Mr. McCotter stayed in the race, I would be surprised if Mr. Bentivoglio got within 30 points of him in the primary. But as we know, he didn't, and Bentivoglio was, for all intents and purposes, had the field to himself, and in a heavily Republican district, went on easily to get elected in November. But now, after sort of auditioning as a loyal Republican who would follow leadership and play ball with the Speaker, he's sort of reverted to his original iconoclastic persona. He was one of the five Republicans in Michigan who voted against the compromise. And he still will tell you in all earnest that not raising the debt ceiling and forcing the government to put on the brakes and stop paying for things it's already contracted to pay for would be the best possible medicine for the economy. I mean, I think he sincerely believes that. But I don't think most voters, even most Republican voters in the 11th district, believe that.
And as you point out, that he did not get a place at the cool kids table. So the GOP establishment has kind of turned its back on him. And he has a credible Republican opponent in David Trott.
He has a very well-financed Republican opponent. I think Mitch Benevolio has something like $50,000 in his coffers, and Trott raised more than 10 times that in his first 30 days. So he's really in trouble, again, in his own primary.
Anything you want to add to that, Ken?
Well, I guess my view is that Congressman Bentivoglio, he'll never be able to overcome himself in this situation. His elevation to Congress was so unique and odd, and his own sort of personality is so unique that I just don't think he'll ever be able to overcome himself, and he'll be defeated in the primary.
Let's look at what needs to happen, Ken, your view, on behalf of the Republican Party. What needs to happen when January and February roll around, and here we are again facing the same deadlines for the budget and the debt ceiling?
Well, I think, you know, and having been elected and served in the Michigan legislature, not in Congress, but as you get closer to the election in November, and January and February of next year is closer, their calculation changes a lot, dramatically. I think they're thinking to themselves that the perception of us is so negative right now because of what we did and how we did it, we're not going to go down this road again in January and February. So I would be very, very surprised if we saw a replay of this last couple weeks. Now, all they did really is they kicked the can down the road till January, February, or March. But it's a lot of observers are saying, you know, I don't see anything that's going to change things. They're going to do this again. But their own personal political calculation is we're a little too close to this November election. And in some cases, to August primaries. I don't think they want to replay this. I think they're going to figure out a way to either resolve it, maybe just by kicking the can down the road again, but to go up against the debt ceiling like this or to face potentially another government shutdown, I don't think they're going to do that.
And Brian Dickerson, what do you think Democrats should be doing to capitalize on this voter anger that's alive right now and turn it into something useful a year from now?
Well, I'm less interested in what's useful for the Democratic Party than what would be useful for the country. And I think the White House has made some good choices about priorities. I think the country's disgust and the Republican House majority's desire to be seen as a constructive force that can do things will both help the president on immigration and a farm bill. Senator Debbie Stabenow was saying there are a lot of Republican congressmen who can't afford to go into their next election with their party having blocked a farm bill that farmers in their states are depending on. So I think that'll probably get done. I think there is probably some basis for optimism that they can make progress on immigration. And I would hope both those things are true.
Cynthia, can I add something?
Absolutely.
I from my standpoint as a Republican, I think one of the great ironies of this mini Republican disaster is they made it all about Obamacare. You know, they were going to shut down the government. We're going to blow through the debt ceiling because they wanted to either defund or stop or change Obamacare. And the great irony is that the problems with the health exchanges and the websites demonstrate some of the risks or problems of Obamacare in and of itself. And, you know, they sort of single-handedly managed to to sort of put that on the back pages for a while they led themselves into disaster. And I just think that's one of the great ironies of this failed strategy they utilized.
I couldn't agree with Senator Sikkema more.
Appreciate your insights, both of you, Brian Dickerson, Detroit Free Press, and Ken Sikkema, who is the former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. He is now a Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thank you so much to both of you.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
There are literally tens of thousands of apps available for your tablets and your smartphones. But there is only one you can download for free, by the way, that will teach you Ojibwe. The Ojibwe are also known as the Anishinaabe people. They're among the largest group of Native Americans, and many live here in Michigan. Derek Baxter is president of Agoki Learning Systems. He helped design this app that could go a long way towards keeping the Ojibwe language alive. Derek, it seems to me there are several ways to view this app and what it can accomplish. First, for those of us who are not Ojibwe, a chance to not only learn some phrases, but learn about your culture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So people say that if the language dies, then the culture dies, and I find that couldn't be more true. Some days you see students in school that are Ojibwe and they can't speak their own language, and that's really unfortunate.
We've seen indications that the Ojibwe language is really one of the very few Native American languages that is expected to survive. Do we have any sense of how many speakers there are?
Yeah, so actually the Ojibwe language is part of the Algonquin languages. So there's very similar languages being spoken in the Algonquin languages. And because some of the communities are using the Ojibwe language to teach in schools, the Ojibwe language is actually the first language that's spoken in the schools. So you have English as a second language. So it's not until the students get to grade 5 or grade 1 or grade 2 that they actually start to learn English and engage in English, and that's really the strength of the Ojibwe language. So we know that languages are going extinct. One language is going extinct every 14 days, and fortunately, because of the strength of the school system and how the parents are teaching their children Ojibwe within the small communities, the language is probably going to survive for quite a while.
It's a very easy app to use. I have it downloaded on my iPhone right now, and it loaded up that I got at the App Store. And you've got all kinds of categories. For example, if you go to the greetings category and you want to learn to say thank you, you touch the button that says thank you, and
Miigwech.
And there she is. Or if you want to say what is your name?
Anin Eshinikaswen.
Very different.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of the Algonquin language, right? So the Algonquin language includes Cree, Ojibwe, and some other languages, and really it's using some syllables and some combinations of letters within the pronunciation that really we're not really used to. So when we go back to it and say some of these words, they may sound like they're unfamiliar to us, but that's how the language is spoken within the Algonquin territory. And in fact, the Ojibwe app itself has been downloaded around 21,000 times so far on both the iPhone and the Android devices. So it's getting out there and people are learning it.
The Ojibwe Language and People app, free to download for iPhone or, as Derek told us, Android devices as well. Derek Baxter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.